From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The modern president is America's shrink, a social worker, our very own national talk show host. He's also the supreme warlord of the earth. Those are the words of author Gene Healy, and he's not happy about what he sees as the evolution of the American presidency into a role with ever-expanding powers. We're going to talk to Healy, a senior editor at the Cato Institute and the author of The Cult of the Presidency, and to former presidential assistant Ron Christie. He's also the vice president of the lobbying firm DC Navigators. We'll ask them what the president really does and what the Constitution says the presidency is. After all, in our day and age, the president is like the lead singer of a rock band, always on TV, always out in front. The president runs the executive branch of the federal government, but we've got two more branches, the legislative or Congress and the judicial, including the Supreme Court. The three are supposed to share a balance of power. Has that balance shifted too far in favor of the presidency, or does the Oval Office need more power when it comes to issues like our economy? Gene and Ron are joining us now. Welcome.
Nice to be with you.
Thanks for having me on.
So, Ron, let's start with you. In November, we're going to elect a new president. Without talking about the candidates, tell us about some of the constitutional powers that person's going to hold.
Well, Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution of the United States provides the President of the United States with the majority of his enumerated, that is, those powers that are specifically laid out in the Constitution. Perhaps one of the more familiar ones, of course, is the President of the United States serves as the Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces. But also, one of the powers that is also very powerful that people often overlook that came to highlight at the end of President Clinton's term is the president's ability to pardon those who have committed offenses against the United States, save impeachment cases. So the president does this. The president appoints ambassadors. The president appoints judges. The president really has an impact on the domestic and the international stamp of the United States through the enumerated powers of the Constitution that's given to them. But of course, as we'll get to in a second, undoubtedly, those powers that aren't specifically delineated in the Constitution in the modern era of the presidency, I think, have really, really blossomed, and the president's role has expanded significantly, particularly in the age of television.
Gene, the title of your new book is Cult of the Presidency. What do you mean by cult?
Well, cult is really just a shorthand for the way Americans have come to look at the office. We tend to want a father protector, somebody who is going to answer the phone at 3 o'clock in the morning to keep your children safe from harm and grow the economy and teach your children well and all manner of responsibilities. And what the book's about really is how investing that much responsibility in the office, which is clearly more than the framers ever wanted to be invested in it, really leads to an unhealthy concentration of power in the executive branch.
Ron, do you agree that the president has too much power?
I don't think the president has too much power. I think that particularly now where you're dealing with divided government, where the president might be of one party and the Congress is controlled by another, you have a natural check and balance system that is in place where if the executive branch headed by the president tries to overreach, the Congress can either overrule him through a veto. If the president has decided, I'm going to veto this, the Congress can say, well, you know, we're going to overrule you. So I think when you have divided government with divided parties, I think that keeps the executive in check.
Now, Gene, I want to actually move on to some specifics. You know, 5 years ago, the U.S. and an international coalition invaded Iraq. So how did the president take charge of war? And did he overstep, in your opinion, his constitutional bounds?
Well, I would see the problem with the way the Iraq war came about as less a problem of executive overreaching. I mean, in the run-up to the war, the president did the administration did assert that they had the power to go to war without so much as a permission slip from Congress. But in the end, Congress authorized the war. But the way they did it was in a very weak-willed and spineless way. It was very much like the Gulf of Tonkin resolution that authorized the war in Vietnam. They essentially punted the decision of the president. They authorized him to use all necessary and appropriate force, and they authorized him to make the final decision about war. And I don't think the Constitution, the preferred constitutional route to getting into war gets everybody on the same page. You know, ideally you have a declaration of war. And the way that Congress in recent years has chosen to authorize war in this Gulf of Tonkin sort of mold really allows the people in Congress to hold back, see the way things go, test the winds, and criticize the president if things go badly, and support the president if it looks like things are going well. It's really spineless, and it's a complete abdication of responsibility.
Ron, do you think the Congress is at fault in terms of giving up its powers, or do you think they made a smart decision to give them to the president?
I think Congress is in a very dicey political situation. As Gene notes, you know, the last time that you've seen a declaration of war by the Congress, I mean, it's been decade upon decade. The Gulf of Tonkin resolution back in the late 60s and in the 70s with the Vietnam War, and of course the authorization of the use of military force for the current engagement of forces in the Iraq theater and Afghanistan. Congress did authorize the president to take all necessary means to confront that enemy. But again, it's Congress's responsibility, given that they can declare war and send, you know, that declaration on to the president. If they pass an authorization of the use of military force, and after having worked with the particular president, President Bush, in this particular instance, to help craft that authorization, I don't think that Congress has abdicated their responsibility, nor have they been weak in allowing the president to exercise their power. But Gene correctly points out that Congress does have a constitutional role in the waging of war and the authorization of that, and that Congress has been a little less stringent, I would say, in their authorization and the application of that in the last 30 to 40 years.
Let's run quickly through a couple more issues. First of all, the economy. Now, many economists think the U.S. is headed into a recession, and the president championed the economic stimulus rebate checks. Ron first, and then Gene. How much power does the president actually have, for good or bad, to change the economy?
Honestly, not that much. I mean, certainly the president can work with the Congress to enact legislation to bring about a particular result. In this case, as you point out, the rebate checks that go back to taxpaying families of a certain income level. But the president of the United States, I think, has the most power of using that bully pulpit, using the Oval Office, using the power of the podium to push Congress and to implore the American people to take certain action. I think that's where the president has the greatest power in trying to influence economic events and to restore confidence in markets where there is confidence that has been rattled, rather than the Congress and the president working together to pass legislation.
Yeah, Gene, the president's always taking credit if it's a good time.
Well, with the 66% disapproval rating, probably the less he says about the economy, the better, and the less he tries to use the bully pulpit, the better. But I would say that, you know, too often, especially in campaign season, the public discussion proceeds as if, you know, the president sits up in the cockpit of the national economy pulling levers and dials, and it's completely inaccurate and inconsistent with what the framers wanted. So I'd agree with Ron that probably the public perception of the amount of power that the president has to influence the economy is not accurate.
Gene, let's move on to the Supreme Court. The president has the power to appoint justices, and in a way, this president kind of won the lottery. He got to appoint two, Samuel Alito and John Roberts. So when a president has a chance, a vacancy on the bench, how important is it to the lasting future of the country?
Well, it can be very important. I think a lot of people with the current president on both sides of the judicial nominations issue have focused too much on issues like abortion. Charlie Savage, in his book Takeover, makes a really compelling case that one of the things that mattered most to this administration was the cementing their theory of executive power, a theory of executive power that says that the president can arrest American citizens on American soil without due process and wiretap at will and things like that. In fact, Savage says that that's how you should understand the Myers nomination, that this wasn't a case of the president trying to reward a friend. It was a case of a president nominating somebody that he knew would be a reliable defender of executive power. And
Nomination failed.
That nomination failed, but I think what you got in Alito and Roberts were essentially Harriet Myers with a better resume.
What do you think, Ron? I mean, in terms of should the Supreme Court basically rubber stamp presidential authority?
Absolutely not. I think this president was very consistent when he first ran for office back in 1999 and in 2000 that he wanted jurists who would, if there was a vacancy that occurred on the bench, would come to the Supreme Court and interpret the Constitution and not seek to legislate from the bench. The president was very clear about that in 2000. He was equally clear in his reelection in 2004 against Senator Kerry that he said that he did not want to put people on the bench who would bow to the current whim of the public perception of what might be popular or not popular. He wanted people who would interpret the Constitution and use that as their stalwart and their benchmark upon which how cases should be decided. And I think the president's been very consistent in that application.
Well, I want to get to one more point very quickly. I'm going to go to Gene first, and again, very quickly. Do you think that the next president, whoever it is, will have restricted powers based on how people feel about the presidency now?
Well, I certainly hope so. I think Ron earlier made the point about divided government, and I think it's a good point. When you have, when you unify the legislative and executive branch in the hands of the same party, unfortunately, the record of the last few years seems to suggest that Congress becomes a rubber stamp, and I don't think we want that.
Ron?
I think that's right. I think that we operate at our best when we have divided government where they're not running the tables on a particular legislation or particular whims of the president. But I don't see a restriction in presidential power, whomever occupies the Oval Office in January of 2009. Instead, I think that with the ever microcosm and the microscope that these candidates and these politicians come under, the president, whomever he or she might be, will have to answer to the American electorate and to the public in a way that we would never have imagined 30 or 40 years ago.
Well, Ron and Gene, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Ron Christie is vice president of the lobbying firm DC Navigators. He's also the former assistant to President George W. Bush. And Gene Healy is a senior editor at the Cato Institute. He has also written the new book, The Cult of the Presidency, America's Dangerous Devotion to Executive Power. And they both joined us at our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. Just ahead, our Africa update gives you the latest news from Sudan, Somalia, Zimbabwe, and Zambia. And Danny Glover goes to Capitol Hill. The actor and activist explains his solutions for curbing the food crisis hitting Africa and the world. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Zambia recovers millions in stolen assets. Sudan breaks diplomatic ties with Chad, and a presidential runoff is likely in Zimbabwe. That's all on today's Africa Update. For more, we've got Amira Wood. She's co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. It's great to see you in person, Amira.
It's a joy to be with you in the same room, Farai.
Well, I have to say also that you look just fabulous. We don't usually get to see you because I'm not usually in D.C., but you've got on an amazing turquoise outfit. So that's my television portion of this. But let's start in Zambia. The government has recovered money and assets worth nearly $60 million that it says were stolen during the rule of former President Frederick Chiluba. And he served two terms as Zambia's president from 91 to 2001. Those assets were bank deposits and an apartment in Belgium. So how significant is this?
Well, it is huge, Farai, because this is starting now a pattern where African leaders are held accountable by their own people. The assets that were taken from the country are actually traced and repatriated. They are returned to the people. And this is an extraordinary step forward for African countries and for the international community.
Is President Chiluba facing any legal charges?
Well, there are legal charges within a UK court. There are charges brought up, actually, for these for the recovery of these stolen assets and for corruption charges as well. So it is an ongoing case and an ongoing issue. But this return of now over $40 million is a huge step forward.
So there's a new United Nations Convention Against Corruption. What is that?
It is the first internationally legally binding convention that says countries around the world have the right to go after funds that belong to the people that were actually put in foreign bank accounts and in other assets and can go after, trace, and return, repatriate those funds to the country, return the funds to their rightful owners, the citizens of those countries. So it is a huge step forward. It came about because of the organizing of human rights activists, especially Nigerian human rights activists, that really went after the stolen wealth from Nigeria, especially in the Abacha regime time. And it is now this binding international rule that says that countries around the world can hold people accountable for irresponsible activities.
Now, let's talk about the latest political news from Zimbabwe. We've been tracking that for a while. Over the weekend, opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai announced that he's going to take part in a presidential runoff against incumbent Robert Mugabe, the president. And speaking from South Africa, Tsvangirai vowed to return home shortly to take part in the second round of elections.
I intend to return to Zimbabwe within the shortest period of time, having taken into consideration the feasibility on the ground. I shall return to Zimbabwe to begin a victory tour. Some might say this term victory is cold and callous given the hardships endured by the people. But the people are victorious, and they are being punished for their victory. We must free ourselves from those who would steal victory from fellow brothers and sisters by using guns, sticks, screwdrivers, and bicycle chains.
So we've heard about some of the election-related violence, and for weeks now, Tsvangirai has maintained he won an outright victory. The Electoral Commission says while he won the most votes, he fell short of a majority, and by law, he's got to do a runoff. So are you surprised by his announcement?
Well, there's been a lot of back and forth. Will there actually be a runoff? Will there be an outright understanding that Tsvangirai did win in the election? And so it's been a five-week standoff. What will happen next in the Zimbabwean elections? And it seems that, you know, the decision has been made by the Movement for Democratic Change to go forward with this runoff election and to respect the standing and the ruling of the Zimbabwean Electoral Commission.
Did he really have a choice?
Well, many say he didn't, right? Many say that in order to keep especially the confidence of the people and the confidence of the international community, that he had to go forward with a process that was seen as the next step, that was seen as a commitment to the rule of law within Zimbabwe.
Now, what kind of demands is he making in terms of how that runoff election should unfold?
Well, I think there are a lot of issues now as to when the election will take place. And you know, Morgan Tsvangirai has said it should happen within this coming month. 24 days would be ideal. But there are others that say, well, according to the Constitution, it could be up to 60 days. So 2 months before this runoff takes place. And we know well there have already been numerous reports of violence and intimidation tactics and just outright abuse, particularly of supporters of the MDC and Movement for Democratic Change. And so it is really troublesome to think that there could be an even further extended time period before we know who at last is the president of Zimbabwe.
Let's move on to Sudan. Last week, the Sudanese government launched airstrikes that hit a school and killed 13 people. In response, rebels attacked the capital, Khartoum. Now, let's begin with the bombing in North Darfur. Why was this area targeted? Do we know?
Well, Farai, we know that it's been now 4 years of attacks of basically the Sudanese government deciding that people on that land in Darfur really had no right to political participation, to economic independence, and has systematically targeted those communities to push people off their land, to push them both across the border into Chad, but also into internally displaced people's camps. So it is staggering. 400,000 is the figure that people toss around in terms of those who are made homeless by this violence and actually targeted by the violence. And so we see this as just the latest, this aerial bombardment, actually Antonov missiles attacking a school, you know, killing, it said, 14 people, seven of them children. This is just the latest in the series of attacks that target civilians in Darfur as this crisis, again, continues unabated.
So rebels attacked the capital, Khartoum, in retaliation, and then Sudan cut ties with Chad, claiming Chad was complicit in the rebel attack on Khartoum. So what's the relationship between Chad and Sudan?
Well, it's been a difficult and complicated relationship. So, you know, there were wonderful photos taken about 2 months ago when Chad and Sudan signed these new diplomatic arrangements that there would be a sort of a commitment made for peace on both ends. And that was wonderful. They signed it in Senegal at the Islamic Conference and everyone applauded and then went back home to further tensions. What has happened is you have had both governments accusing the other of supporting rebel movements. So you have the government in Chad, accusing the Sudanese of supporting rebels there, trying to oust the Debe government in Chad. And then on the other side of the border, you have the government in Sudan accusing the Chadian government of supporting the rebels that have attacked now in Sudan.
All right, one last topic. We're going to the Horn of Africa. Tens of thousands of Somalians hit the streets to protest soaring food prices. At least 5 people died in those demonstrations, and some stores refused to accept banknotes because they feared some of them were counterfeit. So the UN says half of Somalia's 7 million people are facing famine. In a few minutes, we're going to hear from Danny Glover, actor and activist. He went to Congress to talk about this. But the average income in Somalia is under $1,000 a year. What kind of pressure are we really talking about here?
Well, what you're talking about is political pressure primarily. Let's remember Somalia had a government that for the first time in 15 years brought peace, brought stability. And the U.S. decided that because they had Islamic in their name, it was the Union of Islamic Courts, that that government had to go. And so the U.S. orchestrated the ouster of that government from December 06. So from December 2006 till now, 15 months, we have had chaos in Somalia. And the result of that chaos is a human suffering that is taking a heavy toll. There are an estimated 1 million people forced out of their homes in Somalia. Well over now, the estimates from the Amnesty International report just this past week was that 6,000 people have been killed in the last 15 months. Other estimates are much higher. The Somalis say the number is closer to 10,000. So what you have is a humanitarian catastrophe because of the political crisis caused by the U.S. ouster of a Somali government.
Now, we should say that the U.S. and others did accuse the Union of Islam, the Islamic Courts government of, you know, perpetrating atrocities. So there's a difference of opinion on that. But now that there is this famine looming, do you think that the U.S. and international community will come together to help out?
Well, the issue with the food crisis is a global issue. And clearly what's at stake is that the especially large businesses here in the U.S. and in Europe that have dumped their agricultural products on markets around the world have to curtail that action. The subsidies to those large businesses has to end. So in the end, resolving the food crisis will take longer-term structural change.
All right, Amira, always great to see you.
Oh, the time goes so fast. Thanks so much, Farai.
Amira Woods is co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, and she joined us from our headquarters in Washington, D.C. Now we've got more on the food crisis from a different angle, activism in the United States. Many Americans are tracking the unrest over food prices and possible famines. The crisis includes not only the deadly riots in Somalia, but protests in African nations including Egypt, Cameroon, and Burkina Faso. The high price tags on basic foodstuffs could lead to malnutrition and even starvation. Activist and actor Danny Glover is trying to get the food crisis on the government's agenda. He's the chairman of the board for Trans-Africa Forum, and he recently spoke to members of Congress about the impact of the food crisis on children around the world. Danny, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So what was the purpose of your trip to Capitol Hill?
Well, I was part of a panel and a briefing for Congresswoman Sheila Jackson's Lee committee on the current food crisis. As you know, there's going to be, and you may not know, there's going to be a congressional delegation that's going down to Haiti. But as we all know, the crisis itself is not simply stationed in Haiti. It's a problem with the global south and poor countries in Africa, and or whether they're in South Asia, whether they're in Latin America.
Many people know you as an actor and producer, but not everyone knows that you're chair of the board for Trans-Africa Forum. How did you get involved in looking at the issues that affect the global south, as you call it, and specifically this food issue?
Well, I have a longstanding relationship with Trans-Africa Forum, which dates back to the anti-apartheid movement. I supported the abolition of apartheid doing the work of the great South African playwright Ethel Fugard, but also by my involvement in the African Liberation Support Committee and other organizations. So there's a long relationship with that. The question of food is very much tied into the question of development and certainly the question of infrastructure building and also the question of health as well. I mentioned Africa, but close countries in the global south, as we refer to them, the undeveloped world, have had a very peculiar relationship with the countries from the north, the developed world. And a great deal of that is functioned around trade. Certainly, we look at countries that at one point been sustainable in food production, often being able to export food, now are dependent upon buying food at exorbitant prices, even before the current crisis, which does not allow them to put money in social development, in education, in health care. We can go back, even if we look at the crisis in Africa, take, for instance, Kenya. Kenya, at the time of its independence, over 40 years ago, was self-sufficient in food. In fact, Kenya was the breadbasket of Eastern Africa. It sold food to the other countries in Africa. So we look at Kenya now solely dependent upon tourism as a revenue source and having to buy food, purchase food, in order to meet its demands. We see that played out in places like Zimbabwe. We see it played out in other places as well. And the beneficiaries are those who are the big conglomerates, the multinational corporations, and also the big producers of rice and corn and other important staple goods that are needed on the continent.
What you're saying recalls Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General. He was saying that high food costs could wipe out all the progress that development projects try to achieve. So if things continue as they are, do you see developing countries slipping even further from the standard of living that we see in the West?
Well, we see that happening right now. We even see that in relationship with the crisis of, around the housing crisis. You know, the fact is that over the last 35 years, the majority of new wealth has been skewed to those in the top 1 to 5% of the population. So you see a medium income among working people in the United States being virtually stagnant over the last 35 years. And they've had to find other ways to pay for essentials such as oil, food, housing, and health care when possible. This is happening in the richest country in the world. And what has happened is that workers here in the United States work an average of 250 more hours a year than the average European worker. They also, you see, that women have entered the workforce, not primarily because there are new opportunities for them, but primarily to supplement the family income. All these are real issues. The fact that we have consumer credit, and consumer credit has just exploded. So you have people here totally spent. And if you can imagine here in this country, imagine the kind of dynamics that play out in poor countries and low-income countries and middle-income countries as well.
How do you feel about food aid? And what I mean by that is that CARE, which is one of the largest aid organizations, actually decided not to give some forms of food aid because it felt that it would undercut local economies. Is there a trap sometimes? I mean, when people are starving and desperate, there's very few choices. But in terms of doing things like reinvesting countries in having their own food sources, what do you think a good long-term game plan would be?
We have to construct people-oriented relationships. Now, this is a bit of idealism, of course, and it's wishful thinking, of course. But if we don't have some sort of reconstruct our relationship of aid based upon that in which the people are given the capability of sustaining themselves, then what we've essentially done is we'll go through this crisis again. Now, if we can imagine at some point in time, with a little tweak here, a little tweak there, these countries being able to be self-sufficient and growing food, so we're going to have to localize this process. How do we localize this process? How do we get the the agribusiness and everything out of the process of really betting on the price of food in relationship to people starving?
Well, Danny Glover, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Actor, producer, and activist Danny Glover is chairman of the board for TransAfrica Forum, and he recently briefed a congressional panel about the global food crisis and its impact on children. He was at our headquarters studios in Washington, D.C. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Throughout this election season, we've been checking in with black voters in key primary states. Today is West Virginia's turn. The Appalachian state is only 5% black, and we've got two folks who can give us an insider's view on life in West Virginia. Reverend Audie Murphy is the local NAACP chapter president for Logan Boone County, West Virginia, and Todd McFadden is the associate director of the Center for Black Culture at West Virginia University. Gents, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
So, Audie, how would you describe the area where you live?
Rural and depressed in some way because of the lack of jobs that are in the area. But as far as the mental state of the people, very exciting.
So how black or white or other is your part of the state?
The two counties that I am president of, we hold about 3% of the population as far as being black.
So, Todd, I'm going to go to you. You are originally from my hometown of Baltimore, and you've been living in West Virginia for about 8 years now. Why did you make that change?
That's correct. Well, I actually came to West Virginia to return to my education, to go to school at West Virginia University, and was sort of pulled in to work at the university and have enjoyed my position here, working sort of to spread the word about the black culture throughout West Virginia and as an advocate for black students at West Virginia University.
How many black students are there at West Virginia University, I mean, as a proportion?
Well, about 3.5%, a little less actually. In this city, the number is about 4.5%, which is a little more than the rest of the state, which hovers around 3.5%.
I'm going to ask you this first, Todd, and then go to Audie. And I want you to do this without mentioning the candidates.
Sure.
But what do you think that West Virginians want in terms of political leadership from the president? What, you know, jobs, you know, what kind of issues are affecting people in West Virginia?
Well, I'll go first. In West Virginia itself is a little different in that I think the local politics are very much Democratic, mostly I think because of its ties, the Democratic Party's ties to big labor. But its national politics are increasingly, I feel, very Republican in nature. The tone, the kinds of issues that Republicans care a lot about resonate with the citizens, I believe, of West Virginia. And I think that the issues in particular vary from area to area. This is a little more cosmopolitan part of West Virginia, if you will, in Morgantown because of the university. Other parts are a lot more rural, and certainly the energy issues with having ties to coal is very important.
Audie, what do you think about what people want in the state from politics or what people in your local area want?
I think that what would profoundly affect our area as far as the political thinking machine would be to bring about mountaintop removal, clean coal, and the burning of clean coal, and to utilize the energy that we have in this state, especially with the gas prices going so high, and coal is so readily available in our area, and it has the metallurgical coal, which is the best burning coal. All we have to do is find out how to burn it clean, more cleanly. So we need to research more in that area and also on the mountaintop removal as far as getting permits to do that. And also the factory jobs which could come into this area even after having the mountaintops removed. Those flat lands could be used to have factory jobs to come in, such as Toyota. We have a big plant that is located two counties beyond me in the Putnam County area, which is helping out tremendously, and wood plants that are coming in the area as well. So I would say that the politician will have to address those issues, something that's very concerning to us, and those jobs can bring in a satisfying income to where one can will be able to support their family.
Todd, there was the case last year of Megan Williams, the 20-year-old black woman allegedly abducted by six captors. She was allegedly tortured, sexually assaulted, and forced to eat unmentionable things. Do you think that reflects what's going on in West Virginia race-wise?
Well, not really. But it's sort of an odd place in the sense that, I guess, in my personal experience, I've never had anyone very intentionally or with ill will say anything untoward towards me. But here I'm still called colored a lot. So there's a strange dichotomy of kinds of circumstances I think the black population here has to live with it in one sense. And again, nothing ever happens that is, you know, mean-spirited or anything. Not often, but you do have to become accustomed, I think, to a very different way of viewing things. In one sense, I hate to say almost a naivete, is refreshing, because some of the kinds of less than savory things that we persons might bring to sort of intercultural relationships are not there.
Well, Todd, we're going to have to wrap it up. And
sure.
Todd and Audie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have been talking to Todd McFadden. He's the Associate Director of the Center for Black Culture at West Virginia University in Morgantown, West Virginia, and also Reverend Audie Murphy. He's the local NAACP president for the Logan Boone County chapter in West Virginia. This is NPR News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Simone. The name alone evokes the High Priestess of Soul. Nina Simone passed on her vocal DNA to her daughter, Lisa Simone Kelly, whose stage name is simply Simone. Her first solo CD is entitled Simone on Simone. It's a musical tribute to her mother. Simone joins us from New York. How you doing?
I am doing just fine.
So it must have been maybe bittersweet to do this kind of a record, knowing obviously that your mother has passed on.
You hit it right on the head. Bittersweet does describe this journey and this process. I'm happy to report, though, that it's more sweet than bitter these days.
How did you go about deciding to do this album in the sense that obviously, you must be very familiar with your mother's music, and of course she's got millions of fans all over the world, but then you had to make choices about what songs to do and how to do them. Take me into your thought process about how you put this album together.
I was approached with the idea of doing a big band project, and I wasn't thrilled at the beginning because I wanted to get to some of my own music, but as I went through a lot of the charts that my mother bequeathed to me, I saw that many of the songs ranged in anywhere from 13 to 21 pieces, and that they also were songs that just happened to be a lot of my favorites growing up. So I compared them to the albums that were my favorites as well. Six of the songs off of the Simone on Simone CD are from the High Priestess of Soul album. I realized that this was actually a great idea. So I picked out the songs. I matched them up with the albums. It just so happened that I had an amazing big band, the Rob Stoneback Big Band, right there in Pennsylvania that was ready, willing, and able to help me to do this. And so we just went into the studio and we did it.
High Priestess of Soul came out in 1967. And what was it about the songs that you chose that make them timeless, as well as a moment that your mother created?
Well, it was a personal choice. I wasn't thinking in terms of what the public would remember or what they would think. I mainly approached it in terms of how those songs evoked feelings in me from different phases of my life. Many of them I've been singing since I was 3, 4, 5 years old. So to be able to record Gal from Joe's, which I'd never sung alone, to be able to record I Wish I Knew How It Feels to Be Free, or even How Long Must I Wander, which has always been a favorite of mine since her Here Comes the Sun album came out, which that song is from. Don't You Pay Him No Mind has been a song I've loved since I first heard it and always wanted to do. So it was very personal. And it just so happens that the songs that I chose seem to have put together a wonderful CD that people seem to be enjoying very much.
Now, your CD opens with your mother introducing you at a concert in Ireland.
I would like to introduce you to my daughter. Her name is Simone. We have never sung on the stage together. And now I'm going to play for her to sing a song to you. What's the name of it, honey? I forgot.
Music for Lovers.
Music for Lovers.
When was this and what was the occasion?
It was July 24th, 1999. I forget the day and I forget the hour, but it was one of the most thrilling moments of my life. I always wanted to share the stage with her. I told my mom that I was her background singer. I had always been her background singer. She just didn't know it. So 3 days after my daughter was born in 1999, she flew to Chicago. And while she was there in Chicago with me, we went into the studio and sat down at the piano together. And I got a chance to have my own request, my own Nina Simone request line. And she was amazed that I knew as many of her songs as I did. And the favorite one of hers that I sang for her was Music for Lovers. I sang and she played.
And there's music for lovers in the hush of my dreams of a child.
What's your favorite song? You have rattled off a list of amazing songs, but if you had to pick one off of your album that you love to listen to yourself, what would it be?
All of them. Feeling good.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Towards the end of that song, it's very obvious that I began to tell my own story. And when I get to the point where I say freedom is mine and I know how I feel, it's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me. It exemplifies where I am in terms of my life right now. And something just happened and we caught it on tape and it's there on the CD. And when I sing that song now, which I close my show with, people seem to understand where I'm coming from. It's not just a song that I'm covering of my mother's. It's me letting people know where I'm at.
You know how I feel, river running free. You know how I feel, blossom on the tree. You know how I feel, it's a new day, it's a new dawn, it's a new life for me, and I'm feeling good.
Let's talk a little bit about your mother. She's someone who sounds as if she was fierce from day one. As a child, when she was giving a performance, she basically had a civil rights moment so black folks could sit in the front of a concert hall. Was she as fierce in private as she was in public?
What do you think?
I assume so, but you tell me.
It wasn't a mantle that she donned when she got on stage. My mother was... she was real, from the rooter to the tutor.
You must be thrilled that things have turned out as well as they have, given that you didn't go straight into this career? Do you think that you would have always regretted it if you hadn't decided to pursue the music?
I think that there's a part of me that would have always wondered what might have been, most definitely. I get such joy from singing, and I seem to be able to inspire joy in others when I sing, that I just can't imagine doing anything different with my life, especially at this stage in my life. I've taken a lot of detours to get here, and I've overcome many obstacles that and many naysayers who said that I could never do it. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful feeling to be self-actualizing at this point in my life and my career.
Tell me a little bit about the foundation, the Nina Simone Foundation.
Well, the Nina Simone Foundation was formed shortly after my mother died, in less than a week. And the reason why I formed it at the time was so that people would have a place to send flowers and cards, since Mommy lived in France and there was no real address here in America for them to send it to. I had no idea what a foundation was. I had no idea what a 501c3 was, much less what that I would have to come up with a mission at the time. So I say all that to say that God works in mysterious ways. And so right now, the mission of the foundation is to educate children through education and, through recreation and through music. My mother's hope was to educate children primarily in Ghana, in South Africa. So I just broadened her wishes to encapsulate all of African American children, as well as other children of ethnic backgrounds.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free.
We were joined by Simone. She's debuting her first solo album called Simone on Simone, a tribute to her mother, Nina Simone. She joined us from our NPR studios in New York.
I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear.
That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, we'll put the results of the West Virginia primary under the microscope with our political contributors, Mary Frances Berry and Robert George.
Should be free.